Join the Toronto Holocaust Museum and its partners for a community-wide Yom HaShoah commemoration on Sunday, May 5th. A moving evening of film, candlelighting, music, and a tribute to survivors we've recently lost. Keynote speaker Yoni Berus from Yad Vashem will reflect on Holocaust remembrance post-October 7th. The program is at Beth Emeth Synagogue at 7 p.m. Register at torontoholocaustmuseum.org.
This is Bonjour Chai, the Medium's Messy Edition. I'm Avi Feingold, and I'm here with Phoebe Maltz-Bovey. We are your Frozen Chosen. On today's show, we talk about a photograph of Shani Luke that has caused quite an uproar, and are phones really killing the next generation? All this and more coming right up. There is a bit of a controversy, Phoebe, around a photo that was taken of young woman Shani Luke and her captors, presumably her torturers, likely even her killers, from Hamas on October 7th. And it won a prestigious photo award. And there has been a bit of a backlash against this. We decided to bring in our resident in-house expert for all these types of matters, Ranit Novak. She is the art director at the Canadian Jewish News. She has been a photo editor in editorial news photography for almost 20 years now. She has been on multiple photojournalism award juries, so she is exactly the person that we want to bring in to be able to talk about these things. Rudy, welcome to Bonjour Chai.
Thank you very much for having me. Hi, Avi. Hi, Phoebe.
So can you tell us, first of all, what this photograph is, what award it won, and how these types of things happen?
Yeah, so it's a photograph that was shot in the morning of October 7 when Hamas was attacking Israel. The photo is of Shani Luke. She's 22 years old. She was at the Nova Festival, and she is in the in a pickup truck, and she's not very well dressed. She's dead. She's facing down, and she's surrounded by five Hamas terrorists and guns, and they're celebrating her death. So she... that photo was part of a collection of 20 photos that won in the category of Team Picture Story of the Year. And the award was the Missouri School of Journalism Pictures of the Year International. So that is their 81st year of giving that award. So it's a very prestigious award. It's been around for a very long time. There's a panel of judges, and they look at multiple submissions. And this was one of approximately 10 submissions that they discussed and looked over, and looking at all 20 of those images within that submission, they decided to give that submission from the Associated Press the award of Team Picture Story of the Year. So the image of Shani Luke is one of those 20. The submission of 20 photos involved Gazan photographers and Israeli photographers. And it was chosen because it depicted both sides of the massacre. So it showed what was happening in Israel on October 7th. And then it also showed images later on of Gaza.
Okay, so there's been some backlash against it. I saw that her mom had posted negatively against it. That's not how she wanted to be remembered. The Israeli government Twitter posted something very similar. And you have journalists such as like even Chen Mazig, who was saying things like that the image dehumanized Luke. But then you have Luke's father, Nisim Luke, who told Ynet that he was pretty glad that the photo won the award. And he said it's good that this is one of the most important photos in the last 50 years, or some of the photos that shape human memory, and this is one of them. How do we make sense of this picture in light of like what side to like, how do we think about what the value of this picture is, given that we have people who want it, people who don't? Does it even matter who's arguing about this?
Yeah, well, we can start with her father, Nisim Luke, who did say, if I start crying, what will come of it? Okay, and that's an important quote, because what happens when a person is killed and the photo is publicized? That person is already killed. That is already history. That is already happening. As an Israeli, he knows that this is a legendary, important event, and you can't stop that information from disseminating. So, of course, he wishes that never happened. Of course, he wishes that photo never existed. But at this point, it's out there and it tells the story. And the only thing that he can hope for is that it does help tell the story of what really happened in Israel and you know, goes on in history. The idea of dehumanizing subjects is something that is always a conversation in the history of documentary photography and photojournalism. In war, there is death. War photographers are going to photograph death, and that is the awful truth of war. So even going back to Robert Capa, who was a Jewish Hungarian photographer and founded Magnum, he photographed death and he was lauded for that. And throughout the history of photojournalism, you're always going to see images of death. So you cannot say we can show these and not these. It is part and parcel of war photography. Even if you look at Emmett Till, for example, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old. He was tortured in Mississippi in 1955. The photos that his mother allowed to be photographed of him in his open casket funeral, it basically propelled the civil rights movement in America. She said she wanted an open casket so that people could see what they did to my baby. And that is kind of similar to what Nissim Luke is saying as well. There is a petition right now that is trying to get the sponsor of the award, Nikon, to revoke the award, to take it away from the Associated Press. At the time of me looking today, 120,000 signatures on that. And if you look at the reasons for that petition, they're saying, one, it's disrespectful and raises ethical concerns about photojournalism. So like I said before, that's kind of a moot point. Photojournalism is going to depict war, and war involves death. And that's part and parcel of telling the truth of that event. But what they also said, which I think is the most interesting aspect of this photo, is that the photographers potentially had prior knowledge of this event. And that is, I think, the most interesting reason for why people are angry that this photo is getting spread.
Yes, that is exactly the part I had wondered about. Because at first I thought about this, I was thinking, okay, this is just a bunch of people are confusing representation and endorsement. And you do get that in the world, and I'm sure that is some of it. But then I was thinking about it more, and I was thinking, is this really more about this question that has come up elsewhere regarding this war in particular, about who's who, and this bigger question of like, who's an aid worker, who's doing something else, and who's a journalist and who's doing something else, who's reporting on stuff really also from either side to some extent, and who's an activist. And I think that there's, I'm wondering, yeah, how exactly that's playing into it here. Were there questions with this photograph specifically?
Yes, there were questions about this photograph and other photographs like it that were posted to wire news agencies, including Associated Press and others, on the morning of October 7th. So most notably, Honest Reporting published it. They can't really go so far as to say that the agencies knew, because they really don't know that. What we can say is that we suspect potentially that those photographers who were there knew in advance that it was going to happen. Now, that is only speculation, and there is currently a lawsuit that is taking place in Florida right now. So who's suing is the National Jewish Advocacy Center. They're suing the Associated Press on behalf of the survivors. So what they're alleging is that the Associated Press bought real-time photos of the event and that they paid photographers who aided and abetted terrorism. So that is a huge allegation that's put out onto a major wire news agency. So the wire news agency has responded and said that that lawsuit is baseless, that they documented these events just like they do any other world event, and that without AP and other news organizations like it, we would not know what happened on October 7th. So conceivably, they did not know. They got the call. They started getting photos in on the morning of October 7th. But they did pay those photographers. And so the question is, what are the ethics around using photographers that potentially knew about a crime taking place and didn't stop it, but instead photographed it? And now the Associated Press is disseminating those images and profiting from them because they charge for news agencies to use them.
I was wondering just like how much this has come up in the past, because I know I've seen things like, this has nothing to do with war, but I remember seeing some picture of somebody struggling to carry somebody maybe with a in a wheelchair up some big flight of stairs or something. And then this was spread online as like heartwarming. And then people were saying like, rather than filming it, shouldn't you have been helping? Things like that. And I guess I'm just wondering how often with specifically war journalism, something like this comes up of shouldn't you have been doing the thing rather than documenting the thing? Like, is this a common occurrence? Or is this to more specific to October 7th?
So, yeah, I've been to some photojournalism festivals and have talked to photojournalists about that topic exactly. Some do and some don't. Some praise themselves for doing it. Some praise themselves for not doing it, for not helping. So, you know, is it helping more if you're photographing and showing the world the disgrace that's taking place? Or is it helping more if you stopped that specific thing potentially for taking place, but it doesn't really help because you're just basically eliminating a photograph that could have existed that is also taking place in other areas too, but nobody's there to photograph it? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So going back to the image itself, and you know, like this whole discussion has me thinking about the fact that Israel has been making a lot of use of terrorist imagery, which they captured from GoPros that they captured, that the terrorists themselves were taking pictures and using them as like trophies. And Israel is going and parading these images around in their controlled circumstances. And I think part of the outrage seems to me, at least, that they're not the ones in control of this photo. And then they get to say, well, don't do this, even though they're doing the same thing. So I guess as a lens to talk about this or to ask this question is like, as a picture itself, if regardless of who took this photo, is it a great picture from a photojournalistic perspective? Does it deserve an award on its own, regardless of how it was taken? And then we can bracket those things. Do you like, what's your take of like, as a photo editor on this picture?
Well, okay. Well, first, I don't think that anyone's saying that we shouldn't show the photo. I think the problem is the award, the accolades, right?
The applause. But the award is not for it being beautiful as a piece of art. It's not an art award. It's a journalism award, and which makes the picture important as opposed to, let's say, beautiful or valuable for its innate like photographic artistic value.
Right. So the photo is part of a series of 20 photos that tell the story. So I watched the adjudication process. It's actually available for anyone in the public to watch these four judges talk about these images and why they chose them. And in the end, they chose this series because it has, first of all, tells both sides of the story, the Israel side and the Gaza side. But it also just tells they're gripping images, and the way that they're edited together and pulled together, it kind of has it all of the elements that you need to understand what's happening. And one of the phrases that they used is they said they're gripping images that can tell a complete story of the Israel-Hamas war. And for me, it's bigger than that, just that what they said, what they meant that to mean. They're meaning that the way that they were edited, the photos that were included, they tell the story. They tell both sides, the children, the adults, the soldiers, the civilians, the Gazans, the Israelis. It tells both sides. But actually, by including that one image, it tells an even bigger picture of the way that terrorism uses media to disseminate their message and to disseminate fear. It tells the story of how the news media right now is financially strapped and starved, and they use freelance photojournalists that they maybe weren't able to vet completely to know where their source is coming from and if they are social activists in any way, to use a kind of more muted word. But it tells a much greater story of what the nature of this war is and how the media is used now to disseminate information like this. Like if you go back to, say, the Munich massacre, okay, that is terrorism using the media as part of their terrorism, right? So when Hamas GoPro'd this massacre, they know that these images will be seen, and they're doing that intentionally, right? Because that psychological terror is part of their agenda.
But,
right?
Yeah, and it's just so strange to me, because I guess I keep thinking that surely it would have been so much worse from a pro-Israel perspective had that image not be included, because you see so much denialism about what happened, about the brutality of October 7th, and so much, well, October 7th was nothing compared to what followed, you know, compared to the backlash to it and so forth. And it seems like remembering that that did happen, it's just interesting how documenting the same thing can make two completely different points.
That's right. It's so polarized right now. There's a fear that people are looking at that image and saying, good, she deserved it, right? She's a former soldier. It was a military offense, right? Or on the other side, Jews who are saying we can't depict people in that way. I think it's important if we have the broader conversations about the context and just take our emotions, put them aside for a minute, and just look at what this image conveys beyond just what it is a picture of, but what it represents.
Well, Renit, for the highly, highly visual form of podcasting, we'd love to make sure that anytime we have all these visuals need to be explained, we have you come back on anytime. Thank you so much for this.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Are you in the market for a new watch or a special piece of jewelry? Are you looking for the perfect engagement ring to pop the question? Atelier Lou has all this and more. Eric and the team at Atelier Lou can craft a piece for you, or you can select from some of the exclusive designers that they offer. From a simple bangle to a statement necklace, Atelier Lou can make you or your loved one sparkle. Located in the heart of Westmount in Montreal or online at atelierlou.com, visit Atelier Lou for your next watch or jewelry purchase. And when you do, make sure to use promo code BON18 for 10% off your next purchase. That's atelierlou.com.
As a parent, I am on multiple parent WhatsApp groups. For each one has its, each grade has its own different groups, different subgroups. All I've been hearing about on my various parent chats and in the regular media is the buzz around Jonathan Haidt's article and the phone-based childhood now and all the resultant backlash, lash for it, against it. All of these things are all in the atmosphere right now. We decided to dive into this topic. It is a topic that is of relevance for everybody within the Jewish community and outside the Jewish community. So with us to talk about this is Rabbi Eric Grossman, who is the head of school at the Akiva School in Montreal. He has previously served as head of school at the Frankel Jewish Academy in Boston, at the Ramaz School in Manhattan. And he is a native of Toronto, a regular reader of the CJN, occasional contributor to the CJN. And for full disclaimer, and maybe it'll even show up in this podcast, we have a podcast series together that we have done called Lesson Plans on theories of education and how they're relevant to our day-to-day lives. Rabbi Eric Grossman, welcome to Bonjour Chai.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I guess I want to start off by asking, as a head of school in a Jewish day school, you read Jonathan Haidt's article. Did it resonate with you? Were there things that you said spot on, 100%, this is completely right? Were there things that were a little bit off to you? What were your reactions to it as a coming from a place where you're seeing kids on a daily basis?
I read this article in anticipation of this podcast, and I said to myself, what could I possibly add? Because absolutely everything in this article rang true. And I actually hope I can add something, because it's the article I would have wanted to have written myself. He read it. He wrote it much better than I would have written it, and with a lot more actual data. You know, I have much more analytical data, but everything rang true, Avi, in terms of what he wrote. And we can expand on some of these points. I can speak to some of these points, but beginning to end, absolutely.
So just could I was just going to mention that this is an adapted from, it's an excerpt of his Jonathan Haidt's forthcoming book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, just to give it the context. So he, and just a little bit, maybe we should talk about who Jonathan Haidt is for a moment before we go further.
Yeah, so he's a social psychologist who has been writing a lot about social media, who has been writing about the ails of technology, mostly in the Atlantic. I've seen him a lot in there. He is fairly well respected from what I can see. And the sense that I got, because I asked this question honestly, is anybody backlash against him, you know, is it real or is it just people are uncomfortable with any truths that he's giving and they just have a hard time with what he's saying? As a result, there's a backlash. And it seems to be that it is more the latter than the former, that
he
is.
Right. I was going to say, I think that we should probably set aside the question of there are people who object to his earlier book that he co-wrote called The Coddling of the American Mind, which is about sort of young people today being sort of like the helicopter parented kids and the impact of that.
Right. And at the same time, if I could just jump in, Phoebe, I actually really liked, I did not know about this, this other book of his, I'll admit, but I actually really liked that he opened by talking about this general state of anxiety, because I'm in total agreement that this is a subcategory of that larger phenomenon. And that's really what I've seen. I've been in education for a quarter of a century, and that is one of the biggest observations I've made of what's changed over the years, is this unbelievable increase in overall anxiety among kids. And I find it directly traceable to the anxiety of parents, that parents have become more and more anxious, and thereby their children have become more and more anxious. And this has impacted in only a negative way student learning, student growth, student success. So I actually was very happy. Again, we can focus on phones, but I don't think you can divorce it from the larger context in which he writes. And I'm really glad that he started the article with that frame.
So for those of you who haven't read the article, Eric, can you maybe touch on some of the points where you said everything resonated with you? Can you give us some of the highlights where you were like, oh, this is something that I see regularly, and that is something that I see regularly, pulled out straight from the article itself?
So first of all, the fact that we have a platform now where students communicate, children communicate with each other, that is divorced from the signals that we get from conversations that we have person to person. So we're talking now on the phone, right? We're not seeing each other. We're talking to each other. And we can hear intonations in each other's voices, right? I can hear if, you know, you're hesitant a little bit when you're talking to me, if you really agreed with me, maybe you're a little upset by something I just said a moment ago, Phoebe, and you disagree. I can sense that in your voice, right? Person to person, when we're actually facing each other, that's really much better, because now I can pick up on your facial expressions, you know, little twitches in your eye and such. We became very hyper-conscious of this, right, during the Zoom age, right, during COVID, right, how much of a disadvantage we're at when even you're looking at somebody, but you're not fully embracing the three-dimensional aspects of the signals that people are giving off when they're talking to you. Social media has created a forum whereby people can communicate devoid of any of these signals. So people are, kids in particular, are writing to each other, and they're saying things that are raising anxiety, that are creating conflict, are creating upset in each other. People write things that they wouldn't say to each other. We know all of this. And what the article points out is, as adults, it's very, very upsetting. We've all experienced this. We receive a text from somebody that completely blows us up because we don't know the nuance of it, but children are particularly unequipped. We at least have the experience of adulthood that we understand how this works. Children are particularly unequipped for this type of communication, and this is dominant in their lives, and particularly at a formative point in their lives. So that was just one point from the article that I think is obvious, and to realize the number of hours that kids are spending. I mean, kids are on their devices for upwards of 5-6 hours a day, doing this very, very bad form of communication. And in addition, he talks about the fact that they're losing sleep over this, right? The kids are staying up way, way, way too late, and they're sleep deprived, which we also know is terrible, the sleep deprivation. And again, I'm not even getting into the dark stuff, right? The bad websites, the pornography and all of that stuff. I'm just talking about basic interhuman communication. That this particular platform is disastrous for children.
So something I was wondering about, though, was it seems like there are almost two things going on at once. There's the specific toxicity that you can encounter online and that's particularly bad for children. But there's also just, and this is something I've witnessed as an educator myself, having taught undergrads, where young people seem to be just uncomfortable having any in-person interaction of any kind because that's not what they're used to doing. That's not how they're used to communicating. So they're just socially anxious in real life. So what I noticed though specifically with the when I was teaching was that when I taught sort of before everybody had a smartphone, and I would ask students in a French class, like, turn to the people sitting next to you and do such and such role play at a restaurant, pretend you're at a restaurant, order your food in French, they would just do that. But then once it's sort of the smartphone era, I would say the same thing. And they would just look like, how could you possibly ask me to talk to people who are sitting next to me who I don't necessarily know already? And, you know, and they would just look stunned, like this was this huge ask. And none of this even gets into like what it is they're looking at online. It's just this question of face-to-face being suddenly a kind of suspect environment.
Right. I'm just thinking, since we're in Canada, right, this is like Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message, that there is a particular problem that this, I think, was a very important insight of his. It's not just the message. We focus too much on the message and not enough on the medium itself, and that the medium itself is very deeply problematic. And I think that's important to say, look, as adults, right, we can filter out the content. I mean, I love my phone. I'm constantly on my phone reading articles, academic things, things in the news. I mean, I think I'm actually a very worthwhile user of my phone. But he's making a separate point, right, that there's a problem with the medium itself, especially for children.
I think I'm probably also in the same camp as you, where it's like, if anybody else looked at me or looked at my behavior, they would say, oh, of course he's addicted to his phone. And I think to myself, but I rarely use any of the social media. I don't even post on social media. And the thing that I do the most is read articles. Or listen to music or podcasts or do other things which I would consider quote unquote productive, which I'd be doing anyways, just on a variety of different devices. And here's a device that brings them all together all at once. So how much of that is the medium and how much of it is the message is a really interesting question around this. Like, is it okay to be addicted to your phone if you're doing things like reading all the time and instead you'd be lugging four books with you, but having a phone makes it a lot more convenient, or is it actually dangerous even to have that? And I don't know if, I mean, you're not qualified to answer that necessarily, but you might have some insight, but that to me is still an open question.
Right. And I think just anecdotally, what I've noticed is those of us, and I'm exactly as you are, Avi, I really, I use my phone for very productive things. Although I find it amazing, even with my own children, where, you know, like some interesting topic will come up and we'll be discussing it. And I'll say, like, check that on your phone. Like, just, like, look that up. And they're almost stunned, like, that they could use their phones for, like, something productive, something academic. And I think that goes to the point, we were trained in books, right? We were trained in lectures, right? And it's the same thing that happened again with Zoom. People who were trained in the traditional media actually found the electronic media to be very, very advantageous. I'm sitting in my office and I'm surrounded by thousands of books. You've seen my office, Avi, right?
Yes.
But I seldom use it. And I trained on those books, but I almost never use them because all those books are now online. It's just an easier way of accessing information. But kids aren't trained that way. And I think that's part of the point. Whether you can actually go directly to this medium and use it properly, or if you really have to go through the more tactile media before you can go to the electronic in order to use it properly. It's a good question. I'm not qualified to answer it.
So I think it seems like we all found this article pretty persuasive. I mean, I found the part about children having been kind of in lockdown before lockdown to be particularly well put and all of that. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the counter arguments about phones specifically. And I mean, there's this sort of general one that every generation panics about young people and every type of new technology gets people anxious, whether it's the printing press or the television or whatever. But on a more sort of specific, concrete level, you could make the case that adult life today does involve phones. and that to artificially create this kind of childhood where everybody's playing with like Montessori wooden toys, you know, until a certain age, and then suddenly you have technology, whether this is just what adulthood now is, and that this is just preparing children for the world that they're going to be in.
I don't find it such a power. I'm glad you bring it up. I don't find it such a powerful example. I have no fear that at some point kids are going to be able to use these technologies. I don't think we have to prepare them.
I guess what I'm asking is not just like physically, can you work a phone? I mean, I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I think they could probably figure this out. I mean, like, understanding, maybe having the experience even at a young age of an awkward encounter, like via text with a friend that makes you sad, and building resilience that online, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not just talking about like working a phone. Does that make sense?
So the way I could frame it, the way I've been thinking about it is, do schools have a responsibility, knowing that this technology is not going away anytime soon, to teach communication and to sort of say, well, we know that you're going to be doing this, whether it's now or whether when you're 16, if Jonathan Haidt had his way, well, we have you in school for 8 hours a day. In theory, we can lock up your phones and we can teach you how to communicate with people by being able to pick up on visual cues and being able to do this and be having conversations properly and not just saying we're teaching a text, right? This goes very well to one of the podcast episodes that we did on lesson plans about, is school sometimes is about teaching life skills. And if we're teaching life skills and communication is one, maybe it's time to put that into the curriculum.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Just like we teach about all sorts of things that kids are going to encounter in adulthood, like sex and drugs and alcohol, I would put this in the same category as he does, right? These are all things that are potentially addictive. But as a society, we agree that in certain contexts and in moderation are a pleasurable part of adulthood. And I could even argue in some of these cases, you know, the schools are too radical in the way that they handle these things too. So I think that's a fair argument to say, but I think that's very different than saying, well, you know, we're just going to give up and let kids, just have their phones. We'll just teach them how to use them properly. I think it'll be the same as saying, well, the same thing with drugs and sex and alcohol, is might as well get them started early on this stuff and talk.
Well, I don't think schools decide when people start having sex. I don't think that's something schools can really decide.
Well, but we do. Yeah, but we do set up situations, right, where, so that those behaviors don't happen, right, in school, right? In schools or when kids go on retreats and sleepovers and things, we're very, very careful to the extent that is possible for us to restrict adult behaviors to adulthood. So I think by extension, we could say the same thing about this technology. I don't know if we're getting too far afield.
But I would even put it more neutrally and say that, if we understand that people talk in a certain way, if we're teaching our kids that there are different forms of communication, and we can say that this is how you write an essay, or this is how you write a poem or a monologue, and this is how you talk, this is how you do public speaking, this is how you communicate with friends in real life, and that it's just as important a skill to know as it is to know how to write things in a certain eloquent manner.
To
say that, well, online communication is one thing, but face-to-face communication is something else, but we have to teach you how to do this because you may not learn it otherwise. And it's the first time in society where we're realizing that it's not so intuitive, that if you slide into, the private world of online communication, face-to-face communication is a skill that we have to learn.
Avi, I think you're totally right about this as a skill that needs to be taught, because I think a lot about the complaints that you would see already before, I'm not even talking about sort of smartphone era, but just about the young people today don't know how to send an email. And you get a lot of people, like especially professors, complaining that instead of getting an email, dear professor so-and-so, they get an email, hey, and I think that these are things where, rather than being annoyed at young people for not knowing how to do the thing properly, if you want them to do it a certain way, that needs to be taught. And I think, I agree with Avi that this is something that it's not just throw the phones to the children and let them, watch videos during class. Obviously, some are going to do that, whatever rules are put in place. But yes, this idea of sort of constructively taking that on as part of a curriculum seems wise. Yeah.
And when I was in high school education, we did this. I think that's fine. But he's not arguing not to do this on that level. We're talking about much, much younger kids from the early elementary years are on their phones or on social media. And also, I don't think we can gainsay the addictive quality of this particular medium. And look, I'll give you another example because it's a grown-up example, right? We all know the deleterious effect that email has had on all of our lives, right? That email has created an enormous, enormous logjam in terms of getting work done. And it's because the medium itself just allows for too much communication too easily. And in the days when you had to write a letter, you had to make a phone call, you thought twice about making a phone call or writing a letter because it was a schlep to do so. And usually by the time you felt compelled to make the phone call or write the letter, the situation had resolved itself. And now people sit down, they shoot off an email. And as a result, the number of situations that we all have to deal with in every single part of our lives has exploded astronomically. I've read every book I could possibly read about how to control email. I've been completely unsuccessful. There is something about the medium itself that is problematic. And I think his argument is that is particularly true of cell phones. And just like I don't have a solution for the email, I don't know that there's a solution to the cell phone thing, but I do think that he is pointing to a particular problem with this medium. I don't want to let that go.
Related to that, I was actually talking to my kids in the car this morning about this, knowing that we were going to be talking about this on the show. One of them made a comment, you know what, like, you can't tell me that my phone is addictive because I know that one day a week, all Jews that keep Shabbat know how to turn off their phone and don't feel the need to like rush to it. Now, that's not entirely true because there is a phenomenon. Maybe you can explain to us, having been at other schools, because I know Akiva for sure doesn't have this because everybody is so wonderful. The concept of half Shabbos is a thing that exists now amongst kids with phones. But by and large, there are many people who know how to have this quote unquote tech Shabbat because they actually have a Shabbat anyways, and they know how to put away their phone and not have to deal with it. Is that counter? Does that like throw a wrench into our thinking about it as an addiction?
Not at all. In fact, it's so funny. In making notes for this podcast, I'm looking at my notes and in the middle of it, it says half Shabbos because I knew that I wanted to talk about it. Maybe I also intuited you were going to ask me about it. So let me tell you why I don't think so.
Because, what is half Shabbos, first of all?
Okay, so let me explain half Shabbos. So half Shabbos is the idea that I'm a Sabbath observant Jew, meaning I don't engage in activities such as cooking or driving or turning on lights, using any type of electricity, all of which it's generally agreed upon in the observant communities are forbidden on the Sabbath. However, I bracket the use of my phone, right? And I use my phone on Shabbos. So I'm a completely observant Jew, you know, a modern Orthodox, a traditional conservative, but I violate, you know, I violate Shabbos in that I use my phone. It's like a vegetarian. I knew this vegetarian who is completely vegetarian, except for her mother's brisket, right? Completely vegetarian, but whenever her mother made brisket, she ate her mother's brisket. A very similar concept, right? I'm completely into these values, but I make this particular exception in this particular case. Okay, so let me address this issue. So first of all, the idea of half Shabbos in life, first of all, it is ubiquitous. I was shocked when this first came out. I remember exactly where I was. I said to myself, that's not possible. I'm an Orthodox rabbi. I operate in an Orthodox context. I go to an Orthodox synagogue. There's no way that anybody in my community uses their phones on Shabbos. And Avi and Phoebe, when I opened my eyes to it, I was stunned. Stunned at the number of people in my community that when I actually did a little bit of, you know, like not digging, but I wanted to know about this. Yes, they used their phones on Shabbos. And why? Because they could not imagine being without their phones, period. Okay. So again, we have to talk about that addictive quality, something you can't imagine being without. So two more points and then I'll let you react. So one is the idea that because I can put it aside for 24 hours does not resonate with me because, again, I grew up in an era where a lot of religious Jews smoked.
I literally have been thinking about this example ever since days.
Right, where a lot of religious Jews smoked. And in fact, in Israel today, in the ultra-Orthodox community, there's still a very, very high level of smoking. It's one of the few one can call permissible pleasures in that community. And people really stop on Shabbos. And by the way, they don't hide it because you can smell it, right? So unlike their phones, which you can hide in your pocket, right? You can tell if someone's smoking. People really stop smoking for 25 hours a week. It doesn't mean they're not addicted. So an interesting, in a couple of the articles about the phones on Shabbos, they pointed out that it was very similar to driving on Shabbos in the last generation. The last generation of observant Jews, right, felt, and this was in the 1950s, right, Avi, felt, mm-hmm. that it was simply impossible not to use your automobile, right? That the automobile was something that even if you're completely Sabbath observant, no one could imagine being without a car. And you know, this was a huge divide in the observant community. And a large part of the community said, we're going to use our cars on the Sabbath, you know, and sort of bracket that again, because we can't imagine being without it. And it proved to be a disaster. Right? Because it destroyed community, it destroyed personal communication, and the people who did it, the community leaders that did it ended up regretting doing it because they said this was a big mistake. And I think this is a similar situation, that this is our generation's thing that they think they cannot do without. And I think we're going to look back on this and say, no, it was a very, very good move for us to say we need to force ourselves to be without this. Again, certainly for these 25 hours, but in other places in our lives as well, which is Jonathan Haidt's argument.
I had never heard of this before, having a half observance like that, mm-hmm. coming at it from the more cynical perspective that I do. I think people pick which parts of religion they're going to do and not do. And it's like, I know people keep all variants of kosher. So, you know what I mean? Like, to me, that doesn't seem so, I'm not shocked that there would be different levels there. I guess I'm not sure whether I would consider it inherently pathological. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody doesn't keep strictly kosher, but like just doesn't eat pork and shellfish, I wouldn't think, oh no, that's pathological. They have this addiction to eating in restaurants, you know what I mean? Like in non-kosher restaurants, you know, I would just think like, okay, that's where they draw the line, you know? So I wouldn't say that that's, I think that's where it's not so straightforward to me, but
I'm more with you on this one simply because in my mind, the notion that what you just said is that everybody picks their level is 100% true, even when you're in a halachically observant environment and situation, in that, you know, I know really observant people who can't go without lip balm. And technically speaking, you shouldn't use lip balm on Shabbat. And this person is aware of it, somebody that I met, and they're like, but I just can't go without it. So that's what I do. Or they're like, but I can't not push my stroller to synagogue on Shabbat because I want our kids, I want our family to be there. And I know I'm not supposed to do that, but I do it anyway. So everybody has their things that they do. And I think that you're right that there's something interesting generationally about that. And I love the image. I never thought about it in terms of cars versus phones. And the thing that underscores that or that confounds it is that half Shabbos, if I'm not mistaken, is much more a below millennial and younger idea. Exactly. Whereas there are many people that are older that grew up without phones. And even if you and I might say that we're addicted to our phones, I don't find myself needing to like just be texting on Shabbat or just be checking my phone for articles or whatnot, whatever it is that I'm using, that maybe I grew up differently, maybe I grew up without it. So I know what it's like. So the people that I find that may be very well addicted are able to not deal with their phones on Shabbat, whereas a younger generation can't not do that.
But in fact, just the opposite. Again, people my age, and you'll tell me if this rings true, generally who I speak to welcome the fact that they can be off their phone for 25 hours and can be doing other things, can be alone with their thoughts, can be reading a book. I find this very much welcomed in that generation. That's why I'm still going to stick to my guns, that I do think this is a phenomenon rather than an instantiation of particular people's proclivities in terms of what they're able to do or where they draw the line.
Sorry, I was just going to say the generational thing, though. I mean, I take a natural Shabbos, as you could call it, of I have little kids and like I cannot be online on the weekend even if I wanted. Like it's just not physically possible.
You're firm by default.
Exactly, exactly. But also into Sunday. So what do you make of that? But what I was going to say about this, though, is I associate being online with work and I like my work and I like the work I'm doing, but that is what I'm taking a break from when I'm not online. You know what I mean? And I think it's different if you're young and everything is online. Your whole social life is online. You know what I mean? It's a very different thing. So they're not worried that they're going to log onto their phone and suddenly they have all the email. They're not going to have bills to pay that they've learned about through their email. They're not going to have like taxes. You know what I mean? Like it's just a very different experience of the digital world, right?
Right. But I do want to bring it back to another point that he made. And this was some data I had not seen before. How many kids want to be offline? How many kids actually recognize that this is not healthy, helpful, happy, right? And they don't know how to extricate themselves.
I thought about, have you seen that in your school at all?
I haven't. That's why I found I found that data point very interesting because, again,
here's my challenge to you to please create an Akiva school-wide campaign in some way or another to see if this is actual real. Let's come up with a real life experiment around seeing if a school can get off of social media.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. And you and I both know that there are these grassroots groups. And I also wonder, on these issues with parents as well, again, this connection with parental anxiety, right? Is it possible that we can create groups of like-minded parents? He talks about this a little bit, right? Who are committed to giving their kids outside time and letting their kids, wander around unsupervised. And they're going to support each other when other parents look at them and say, oh, my God, how could you possibly do that to your child? And we could do that with students, too.
This seems to have become a bit of a social class thing where, like, you hear about sort of tech CEOs who don't let their children use phones and things like that, right? And I think there is something that I've been seeing just as a parent of where it's more upscale not to have the kid in the stroller with a Coca-Cola. Like the little kid in the stroller with a Coca-Cola used to be kind of a sign of somebody who's not very upscale. Today, I think something similar is happening where if you see, a 1.5-year-old in the stroller with a tablet and it doesn't seem to be some sort of extreme situation, I think this has become kind of a social class marker. And that's another, I don't really know what I'm not really concluding anything from this, but I'm saying that I think to some extent this is already happening via that channel, that people think it's more like having a child who's into hiking and, again, like if they're younger, playing with wooden toys is much more upscale than having a child who wants the plastic toys and a screen and a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, look, there's a function of time as well, right? He brings up in the article that we use devices as babysitters, right? And this is very, very much true. And that is definitely a class thing, right? If you can't afford a physical babysitter, a nanny, so you give your kid a device. So for sure, that's a phenomenon. Although I will give one pushback, if I can, on the article. And that was about car trips. So I have to say, I have zero nostalgia for long car trips without devices.
Yes, okay? Yes.
Zero nostalgia.
So much.
I have to tell you, taking all my memories of long car trips without devices, count the cows, look at the clouds. All I remember is just boredom and fighting with my siblings just for something to do. I love the fact that when I go on a long car trip, I can give my kid a device and they can watch a movie. They can be entertained. So I think that does show you we are in a period of time where we're, at least for myself, where we're negotiating what are the goods of these devices at all ages. I'm not an extremist in that sense, but we are a little bit in the Wild West in terms of figuring this out.
One last question about the Jewish community, because you brought up the Haredi community. There's this phenomenon of the filtered phone, of saying that we don't believe in smartphones, that they can be addictive, that there's access to too many things, and that they want you to either get a flip phone, which is just a basic phone, or a smartphone with a filter or internet with a filter. I'm curious if you've talked to other colleagues who are in a more Haredi community and whether that makes a difference. Because on the one hand, what I'm noticing within the Haredi community is that the push against technology is more about the information, that you and I talk about how it's amazing that we have all this access to information, where they don't want that information. Whereas social media is actually one of the hallmarks and highlights of how Haredim use the internet to connect with each other and to be connected with so many other people, to be able to say we're on WhatsApp, we do these things. It's kind of confusing to me how they deal with this and whether there's any data or whether there's any anecdotal evidence, whether it works or whether it's useful or not.
I'm going to give you one anecdote from a different generation, but it's a great story, so I'll share it with your listeners. You know, Avi, that before the smartphone, it was the television. Right. Mm-hmm. That, and you know, there's still Haredi, you know, ultra-Orthodox schools and such that will not let families join that have a television in their home, mm-hmm. which is very anachronistic. Anyway, the head of my rabbinic seminary, my yeshiva, Rabbi Chaim Bravender, so he lived in the ultra-Orthodox community, and he genuinely did not have a television in his home. He was an academic and he didn't have a television. And he was moving. Many years ago, moving into a larger apartment, and the movers arrive, and they said to him, tell me where the television is. And he said, we don't have a television. And the mover said, we know you don't have a television. Please just tell us where the television is. And he said, no, I really don't have a television. And the mover said, yes, we know you don't have a television. Don't worry, we're going to take it out in a refrigerator box. Nobody will have any idea. Don't worry about it. The fact of the matter is, I don't really know how much internet use there really is in the ultra-Orthodox community. I don't know how many people who have flip phones also have smartphones. I don't know. And I think it would be very, very hard to figure this out. How much half Shabbos is going on over there as well, or using devices. I think it would be very, I'm not an expert in that community, but I wonder what the reality is versus the propaganda.
Stated perceptions. Yeah. I hear. Well, I would actually love to hear from people about that. If anybody knows anything about that, write to us. We'd love to hear some of what's going on. We'd love to hear from you if you have anything else to say about this. If you have a kid who's addicted, if you have a kid who's not addicted, if you have grandchildren that are addicted or not, please tell us what your experiences are with some of this stuff.
You don't have to say their real names. That's all I was going to say.
Oh, we're not going to
share your family.
We're not going to tell your family. Well, Eric, this has been most enlightening. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
It's my absolute pleasure. I hope I added something to the conversation.
If you like more of this, you should listen to Lesson Plans with Avi Feingold and Rabbi Eric Grossman, which is available wherever you get podcasts. Come back anytime.
Thank you.
And now it's time for our Naches Broiges. Phoebe, what do you have for us?
I've got a Broiges. Ready, Avi?
I cannot wait.
So it's something that ought to have been a Naches, but then it isn't. So it's a restaurant review in The Guardian by Jay Rayner. They're one of their restaurant reviewers. And it's of a New York-style Jewish deli in London that opened called Freddy's. And that he has this disclaimer in the review. So he's talking about the restaurant, the food they serve, whatever. And he writes, when I first came across Freddy's, I was excited. For all my lack of faith or observance, these dishes, kept alive by a vestigial memory of the shtetl, root me. Then I hesitated. Could I really write about a Jewish restaurant given the current political turmoil? Would I get abuse for doing so? Surely better to keep shtum. At which point, I knew I had no choice. I had to write about it. The horrendous campaign of the government and armed forces of Israel and Gaza cannot be allowed to make being Jewish a source of shame. So that's a quote So then in the review, he goes in this whole digression about the war and analyzing it. And it's not that I think he's wrong in his analysis. His analysis is, you know, like, war is bad. Yes, war is bad. Agreed. You know, the point is he needs to be able to just review a restaurant in London for a British newspaper without this whole thing. Like, it's just, to me, this seems ridiculous. Like, just, is it good or not? The restaurant, review it, fine. And what seemed particularly ridiculous about this is that it's an extremely, like, diaspora food place. Like, it seems like, from what I can see, there's one thing.
I mean, it would make sense if it was reviewing a famous Israeli restaurant.
And I don't think it would make sense then either.
It would be less
extremely ridiculous. It would require more explanation of why it's a problem, but here this is so ridiculous. There's one thing. There's apparently it's a Bloody Mary shakshuka. So there's one thing that he mentions that's, you know, extremely problematic and cancellation worthy, because I mean, that to me, that sounds a little bit nauseating, to be honest, but that's neither here nor there.
So I'm curious, does he actually talk about the food beyond just the
He talks tons about the food, but then he switches gears and asks, and the part that's particularly that I'm really, really stuck on is this part where he writes, could I really write about a Jewish restaurant given the current political turmoil? And it's like, evidently not. Like, evidently you didn't feel you could. I think this was this idea that that Jews cannot just live without this kind of self-flagellation over Israel's actions, right? You know, that this idea that, like, it's too problematic to be Jewish. You should just not. And not as in just don't be Jewish, but just don't be. Like, it's too problematic to be Israeli. It's too problematic to be Jewish somewhere else. Like, as if the only thing that would be an option was, like, some sort of self-immolation. Like, I am so sorry I'm Jewish. I'm so sorry. Let me just disappear. And that's effectively because he could have written the restaurant review. And then if people comment free Palestine on his, and so they closed comments to this article. Okay. So there are no comments on this allowed on this article because it's so problematic, right? You know, the Guardian, I guess, doesn't want to deal with all the people commenting. Like, let that happen. People are going to do that. It doesn't free Palestine to be angry at there being a Jewish deli in London and let the people seem like idiots who are commenting that. You know what I mean? Like, my other podcast co-host, Kat Rosenfield, had a really astute point on Twitter about this, that basically this is similar to, like, privilege disclaimers, where people will write an essay and then they want to sort of preempt criticism by saying, where they're sort of, I acknowledge my privilege, blah, blah, blah. And it only makes people more angry at them, is the thing with that. That's my... Yeah. This seems like the same thing. Like, just review the deli and I am Bruegges. That's all I'm gonna say. I think this is my first real, like, Bruegges, and I'm Bruegges. So that's it, Jay Rayner. I'm sure you know who I am and really care.
All right.
Yeah. So Avi, what have you got?
I have less of a nachas than a request for nachas. Our annual Great Canadian Seder is just around the corner. It is one of the touchstones of Bon Jour Chai, and I love it every year. I love
Avi, do you really
think
that's appropriate in these times, though?
Absolutely.
Are you sure?
This is who we are. This is how we do what we do. And if you have a story, not just you, Phoebe, although you, Phoebe, as well, but if you have a story about your Seder, your family Seder, if you have some insight into the Haggadah that you would love to share with Bon Jour Chai, we'd love for you as a listener to be included in the Great Canadian Seder. Email us at bonjour@thecjn.ca. Let us know and we'll follow up with directions and instructions for how to get that in, because we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear some of your nachas, maybe some of your bregas about your Seders. So that's my big request for nachas, and stay tuned because we will have a wonderful Great Canadian Seder in time for Pesach.
Sounds great.
Thank you for listening to Bon Jour Chai for the week ending April 6th, Shabbat Parashat Shemini. The show is produced by Michael Freeman and edited by Zach Kaufman. The executive producer for CJN Podcasts is Michael Freeman. Our music is by So-Called. We are a project of the Jewish Living Lab and are distributed by the CJN Podcast Network. You can listen to all our past episodes on our page at thecjn.ca/bonjour, and you can subscribe to the podcast and automatically receive all episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you told a friend about Bon Jour Chai. It is one of the best ways we get new listeners. And as always, you can email us with comments at bonjour@thecjn.ca.
Really, I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan, well, have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh,
tell
him. I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.